From Michigan to Mississippi, North Dakota to South Carolina, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the taking of a property's equity above what is owed for real estate taxes is once again an issue headed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Kathy Hoekstra and Christina Martin of the Pacific Legal Foundation discuss the case on this week's edition of American Heroes. A short partial federal government shutdown has ended, but the wrangling over the Department of Homeland Security has not. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. In the state of Nebraska, it is illegal for women to have a medical professional help them with giving birth in their own home. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Joshua Polk of the Pacific Legal Foundation. And the latest census numbers are out. Once again, low-tax states are gaining population. High-tax states are seeing residents flee. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. How much of a property's value can be taken in payment for back real estate taxes? That legal question is headed back to the Supreme Court of the United States. Kathy Hoekstra and Christina Martin of the Pacific Legal Foundation are here to discuss the case. Kathy and Christina, welcome to American Radio Journal.
If you or I fall behind on our property taxes, the government is allowed to take and sell our home to collect what we owe. We may not like it, but it is true. What the government can't do, though, is keep every cent of the sales surplus. Yet local governments across the country did get away with that for years. And even after the Supreme Court said home equity theft is unconstitutional, some states are still finding ways to keep what isn't theirs. And some states, like Michigan, are completely abandoning their lawful duties whatsoever. And that's where the Pung family comes in. This Michigan family is bringing their fight to the United States Supreme Court on February 25th. Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Hoekstra with Pacific Legal Foundation, and this is American Radio Journal. Joining me today is PLF Senior Attorney Christina Martin. She has successfully fought home equity theft for more than a decade and is now standing with the Pungs as co-counsel. Christina, thank you for being here, of course. Before we get into the legal side of all this, tell us a little bit about the Pung family. Who are they?
The Pungs are a family in Michigan who faced predatory treatment from their local government. Rather than the government simply collecting property taxes, the local government ignored the law and ended up imposing a $1,600 tax on the Pungs' home that never should have been imposed. The Pungs had paid all the taxes that were rightly imposed, but the county then used that tax to confiscate not just what's owed, technically, but to confiscate the Pungs' entire home worth almost $200,000.
Yeah, that's crazy. And as a result, Mark and Tia Pung and their young son were actually evicted from their home. They lost their home, but it wasn't just the home. They tried to fight back and tell us what unfolded there. They lost really the equity in their home. It was worth $200,000, and they lost a huge chunk of that over what started as, you know, $1,600 really. So tell us what unfolded there.
Yeah, so the Pungs paid all their taxes that were properly imposed, but the tax assessor had ended up retroactively revoking an exemption for owner-occupied homes. The Pungs challenged that revocation and ultimately won. After the tax tribunal had ruled for them, though, the tax assessor mailed out a bill with the next year's taxes and the exemption applied, but then when they showed up to pay the bill, the county had again revoked it. There's a lot of disagreement about what exactly happened after that in terms of notice and conversations, but there's a few things that everyone agrees about. First, the tax assessor was wrong. That $1,600 tax never should have been imposed. Second, the Pungs didn't pay the improper tax, but they did pay all their other taxes every year. And yet Isabella County ended up foreclosing on the home anyway. The county waited until after they got a foreclosure judgment. They waited until after the time to save their home had expired to let them know that they had a foreclosure judgment from a court. After the county took title, it then the county didn't let the Pungs save their home by paying the tax with interest and fees. Instead, the county fought the Pungs in court to confiscate their entire home. The county later sold it in a fire sale auction for a fraction of its value, about $76,000 for an almost $200,000 home. And the county kept every penny. The Pungs had to bring a constitutional lawsuit against the county, which they partly won. But the court held that the county only had to return the surplus proceeds from the auction. That meant the county had destroyed over $118,000 of the Pung family's equity.
And Christina, this is not your first home equity theft related case. You began this crusade, boy, more than a decade ago. And in 2020, the Michigan Supreme Court said unanimously it's illegal for the government to keep more than it's owed in property tax foreclosure sales in a case that you brought that began with an $8.41 tax debt, which is crazy. Then 3 years later, you argued Tyler v. Hennepin County, Minnesota, at the U.S. Supreme Court, which also agreed unanimously. Now, after Tyler, many states did do the right thing and change their laws to protect property owners' rights to their home equity. But some states, as we mentioned at the beginning, did start down a different path. And this case of the Pungs in Michigan, it's a totally new wrinkle that the Pungs are taking to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court obviously felt it was a big enough wrinkle that they need to hear it and address it. And they're asking, for our listeners, two crucial questions. When the government sells your home to collect a small tax debt, does it owe you your property's fair market value? Or can it lowball the sale and keep the difference? And when does taking vastly more than someone ever owed, or as in the Pung's case, never actually owed, cross the line into an unconstitutional punishment? Do I have those questions right?
For the most part, that's correct. The bottom line is the county only returned $76,000. And the question is that unconstitutional? Did the county violate the takings clause or impose an excessive punishment? And we think that the county did.
Okay, so that $118,000 is really a punishment, an excessive fine.
Yeah, the county, remember, originally took the entire home and deemed it forfeited. And now they've only returned a fraction of the value of the home. And we're saying, look, you never should have foreclosed in the first place over such a small debt, improperly imposed tax, an unnecessary foreclosure, and then you sold it in this way that brought in a fraction of its value. That's not just compensation. And if it is just compensation, it's an excessive punishment.
Yeah, absolutely. And a win for the Pungs would put governments all over the country on notice that, you know what? They better take a close look at their tax foreclosure process and be ready to protect owners' home equity. Well, Christina Martin, thank you so much for all you do for standing with the Pungs and homeowners across the country. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And to learn more about the Pungs case and PLF's continued fight to end home equity theft of all varieties, visit pacificlegal.org. I'll be back next month with another courageous American hero. I'm Kathy Hoekstra for American Radio Journal.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. There's been a whole lot of activity in Washington, D.C., also some political developments. Scott, great having you here. Let's start out, Scott, talking a bit about the fact we had a brief federal government partial shutdown, temporarily resolved, but more yet to come. Want to brief us and fill us in on what's happened?
We go back all the way to the fall where we've had these negotiations with continuing resolutions and the longest federal government shutdown in our nation's history. And then we saw the Congress try to get some of these appropriation bills done. We saw more recently a big negotiation that included our Department of Defense funding and the funding that goes to HHS, two of the biggest appropriation packages combined together, along with a few other subcommittees and appropriations. But there's been this big debate that the Democrats have. You know, in the fall, it was all about extending the Biden-era Obamacare subsidies that were expanded upon during the COVID pandemic. This time, they're sort of moving the goalposts. It hasn't been about health care, and instead, it's been about ICE funding, especially in light of what has happened in Minneapolis. So So the Democrats have been trying to have some sort of an agreement with the administration to stop funding the enforcement of our nation's border laws and stop funding deportations. And, you know, I think that it's pretty silly when you think about how the Democrats' priorities have shifted to make America less safe, because obviously look at the overall deportation numbers, and Barack Obama was deporting a lot more people than Donald Trump is right now. So it's shifting in tone and approach, but I do think it's interesting because the deal that did pass this week, it ultimately funded everything in the government through September 30th with the exception of the Department of Homeland Security. And that's going to be a question that really comes again at the end of next week, pretty much, because it's just a two-week extension of DHS funds, and then we're going to see whether or not the Democrats are willing to shut down TSA and create issues at the airport, or how they're going to try to change the current law when it comes to funding our nation's homeland security.
Well, it seems like these budget battles have become never-ending. We'll keep an eye on that over the next couple weeks as we see what develops with Homeland Security. Another issue that Republicans have placed on the agenda seems to be getting a lot of attention these days. Election integrity, particularly, Scott, making sure that only American citizens vote, that we have photo ID. There is proposed legislation. Tell us a bit about it.
Well, it was called the SAVE Act, and Chip Roy was the author in the House, Mike Lee in the Senate. And you got it right. What we're trying to do here is make sure that only American citizens vote in U.S. elections. You know, when you think about that DHS bill that I was just talking about, the Democrats wanted to ensure that there would be no immigration enforcement in the proximity of a polling place, for example. What do you think that means that they're trying to do to our elections? They're trying to make sure that these 20 million illegal aliens that came into America during those Biden years have the ability to impact U.S. elections. And what we're trying to do here is protect the sanctity of the ballot and of the vote and make sure that Americans are not disenfranchised by non-citizens. And so there were a lot of Republicans that have been pushing for the SAVE Act. President Trump said, you know what, let's add voter ID, let's call it the SAVE America Act. And that's exactly what Chip Roy and Mike Lee decided to go forward with. And I think it's been interesting because, another hand, when you think about this legislation, trying to pass it, there's been the questions on what to do with the filibuster in the United States Senate. On one hand, the cloture rule, where you need 60 votes to end debate, was a tradition that, and a Senate rule that was introduced in the 1920s. Prior to that, in the Senate, you had to do what was known as a talking filibuster, meaning you had to hold the floor. And when nobody else was there to hold the floor, he moved to the question of whether the legislation would pass at a simple majority. And the Senate has obviously changed in function and precedent and the way that the leadership has consolidated power to construct these bipartisan deals, especially under Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid. So they haven't even tried a standing filibuster in decades. And what we can do here is with Senator Thune and the Republican majority, we can force the Democrats to hold the floor to continue to block the Save America Act. And once they're done, we can move forward to passage. Now, there's some experts that say, oh, this is the nuclear option for the legislative filibuster. It's not. It is in the Senate rules right now. You do not have to file cloture to move and get on a bill. Instead, Thune can enter the motion to get on the bill, and then the Democrats can start their talking filibuster. They can have motions to table. They can offer amendments. Can you believe a legislative system where we actually had an open amendment process? It's been decades since we've really had a real amendment process as well. I think this would be a healthy restoration of Senate precedent to get back to the talking filibuster and also maintain the ability to invoke cloture at 60 votes. I think that the Senate is going to have to tell the American people what's more important than preserving the integrity of U.S. elections by ensuring that only Americans vote and passing the SAVE Act. There's, you know, conversations about doing housing legislation and Russia sanctions. I think that the American people voted for Republican majorities to uphold the rule of law and get this immigration system under control and make sure that our elections are secure and that our votes are protected.
Interestingly, there was polling out just this past week, Scott, where even 71% of Democrats agree with the concept of requiring a photo ID to be able to vote. So there appears to be strong public support for that. Speaking of support, the Club for Growth throwing its weight behind another candidate for Congress with its latest endorsement. Who and where?
Well, the interesting thing here is a couple of weeks ago, President Trump endorsed Julia Letlow for the United States Senate against incumbent U.S. Senator Bill Cassidy, a Republican that voted to impeach Donald Trump. And there were several other Republicans that were also running in that primary. One of them is a state senator named Blake Miguez, and he decided to drop out of the U.S. Senate race, and instead he is running for the House of Representatives in the 5th Congressional District of Louisiana. This week, Club for Growth PAC gave him our complete endorsement, and we're really, really excited about the conservative background and experience and record that Blake brings to the table. The good news on top of that is that President Trump also endorsed Blake a day after the club did.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, fill us in a bit about the club.
Well, the Club for Growth and Club for Growth PAC are based out of Washington, D.C. You can check us out at clubforgrowth.org. Learn more about the other candidates that we've endorsed in the 2026 midterms to help us save the House majority and hold the United States Senate majority as well.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for the update.
You're welcome.
If you live in Nebraska and you want to give birth at home, you would be committing a felony if a healthcare professional assists. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine and Joshua Polk of the Pacific Legal Foundation have details.
When Hope Lindstrom found out that she was pregnant, she wanted to have a birth at home, as is your right and as is legal in all 50 states. But because she lives in Nebraska, she found out that, weirdly, she could have that birth at home, but she couldn't get assistance from a certified nurse midwife. And in fact, getting assistance from a midwife in Nebraska was a possible felony offense. Yeah, felony offense. Yeah, crazy story in Nebraska. We're going to talk about that today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Joshua Polk. He's an attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation, and he is one of the attorneys who's now suing over this crazy prohibition in Nebraska, a felony offense for assisting someone with a home birth. He joins us to talk about it now. Josh, thanks for taking some time here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Tell me about your client in this case, Hope Lindstrom, who is really the person here who's going out there and challenging this this law.
Hope has a lot of courage. She's a licensed pastor and a resident of Hastings, Nebraska. She wants to give birth at home with the assistance of a certified nurse midwife. She believes that this is the style of childbirth that most suits her own personal values and religious values. But unfortunately, that choice is being denied to her by the state.
Yeah, the state of Nebraska, yeah, as I said in the open here, I mean, they make this a felony offense for a midwife to assist with a home birth. This is, I mean, maybe I'm crazy here. I don't know. But giving birth at home is legal, but it's a felony to have someone help you do that legal thing. Am I understanding the state's position on this correctly?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. You can give birth at home totally unassisted, which is obviously a risky prospect. But if you want to hire the most accessible and most well-trained childbirth attendant that there is, a CNN, you are barred from doing so. Otherwise, the CNN faces serious jail time.
There are laws similar to this. I don't know that I've ever come across one like this where it's a felony offense, but there are laws kind of similar to this in a lot of places. That, I mean, how does this one really stand out because of the felony charge? Tell us a little bit about sort of the way in which there are other laws like this in other states that more or less, if they don't force you to go to a hospital to give birth, they certainly strongly encourage that.
There's a basic regulations for licensing and professional standards and that sort of thing that might exclude, for example, a lay midwife, someone that doesn't have formal training but just has experience delivering babies. But this is totally different because we're talking about someone who's being excluded from the childbirth experience, who is trained, who is licensed by the state, who has nursing experience and a specialization in childbirth. And they're excluded for reasons unknown to me. The only thing I can think of is just protecting the hospital childbirth services from the competition from nurse midwives who want to deliver outside these contexts.
Yeah, and that's often the case in these situations, right? This ultimately boils down to it's an anti-competitive thing that's pushed in state capitals by whether it's by hospitals or by birth centers, by various entities like this. We see this like in all sorts of different healthcare professions.
I can't read the minds of legislators in Nebraska, but I can't come up with another explanation. And this is something that has been supported by hospital associations and the hospitals themselves in Nebraska. Every year for the last few years, there's been an effort to change this law and to allow CNMs greater independent practice authority and the ability to practice outside hospitals. And every year, hospitals lobby against this change. And so far, legislation's been unsuccessful. So here we are in court.
Here we are in court. Yeah, state lawmakers have missed their chance, so now the judges will get their shot, and we're glad there's organizations like Pacific Legal and attorneys like you, Joshua, are out there willing to take people to court. We are talking with Joshua Polk. He is, again, attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, talking about this new lawsuit they've filed in Nebraska, where they are challenging this honestly quite insane law that makes it a felony offense to assist someone with a home birth in the state there. Josh, about a minute left here. Look, I'm not an attorney. And as I've said a few times here, I find this the whole sort of structure of this law to be kind of crazy. But you can't just walk into court and say, hey, this doesn't make any sense. You have to lay out some legal arguments here, constitutional arguments. Give us, what is Pacific Legal's approach here? What is the legal issue at stake in this case?
Sure. So we're taking a dual approach here. So the first thing is, under both the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment and a local state statute that protects religious freedom, we're alleging that this ban prevents Hope from fully realizing her religious values. And then in addition to that, we're arguing that this violates a mother's right to choose the circumstances and manner of giving birth, which we think is a historically justified right under the 14th Amendment.
Well, we're glad to see that happening, and hopefully this is one of those cases where, you know, hopefully you go and win, obviously. Maybe it's one of those things that spurs some reform even before you get to that point. Josh, we really appreciate you taking some time and walking us through all this.
Well, thank you very much.
And once again, that is Joshua Polk from the Pacific Legal Foundation. You can check out more about this case and about all of their other cases on a wide variety of really excellent topics. They challenge, economic and constitutional issues, as well as, like in this case, a religious freedom claim in Nebraska. We wish them the best of luck with this and with everything else they're working on. All of that, again, at pacificlegal.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The latest census numbers show low-tax states like Florida and Texas continue to gain population, while high-tax states are seeing an out-migration of residents. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this American Radio Journal commentary.
As we reflect upon our 250th year as a nation, migration of the American people has been one of the defining stories. The pilgrims crossed the Atlantic in search of freedom to practice their faith. The frontier of the original colonies pushed west into the fertile land of the Ohio River Valley. Americans set up homesteads across the Great Plains and chased new opportunities in the far west with things like the gold rush. Today, the 50 states continue to showcase substantial domestic migration as Americans vote with their feet across state lines. The 50 laboratories of democracy. When you think about it, it is really an incredible economic experiment. Each state makes its own set of choices on key policies like taxes, regulations, education, and energy. Some of those choices, of course, help their economies grow. They create jobs, allow wages and businesses to grow, and increase prosperity. Other policies burden businesses and workers, leading companies to close up shop and make it harder for families to make ends meet. Well, just last week, the U.S. Census Bureau published the latest data on these migration patterns, and they show that the states embracing free markets and limited government are many times the biggest magnets for this in-migration. As they vote with their feet, Americans make clear which states make the American dream possible and which others are forcing residents to leave in search of that dream elsewhere. North Carolina is the big winner this year. On net, nearly 85,000 individuals moved into the state from one of the other 49 states. This shouldn't be a surprise for astute observers of state policy. North Carolina's lawmakers have undertaken a multi-year effort to create a flat tax for individuals, reduce income tax rates, and eventually eliminate the corporate income tax altogether this decade. This is the first time in decades that another state has attracted more domestic migration in a year than Texas or Florida. However, this success for North Carolina didn't happen overnight. It is the culmination of a years-long turnaround. Today, North Carolina's economic outlook in our Rich States, Poor States, Alec Laffer State Economic Competitiveness Index is fourth best in America, but that's up from a low in 2011 of 26th before its historic free market policy reforms. North Carolina's impressive showing in this migration data suggests that Americans have taken note of this incredible economic turnaround. Among the other states Americans are moving to in this latest data, embrace lower taxes and limited government is a common attribute. The top five is rounded out by Texas, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Arizona. Combined with North Carolina, nearly 300,000 Americans moved into these states from July of 2024 to July of 2025. For the fifth year in a row, California lost more residents to domestic migration than any other state, which is not surprising to many. On net, 229,000 Californians left the state over this period. In total, since 2016, the state has lost nearly 2.3 million residents to one of the other 49 states. That's more than the entire population of New Mexico. It is sometimes suggested that it is not public policy, but immutable characteristics like weather and geography that determine how Americans migrate. But that argument is contradicted by California, with its picture-perfect weather and attractive scenery. It's seen net losses of hundreds of thousands of residents to the rest of the country every year. Income taxes seem to be particularly important to the Americans that vote with their feet. Of the 10 states gaining the most, 4 have no personal income taxes at all, and 4 have flat taxes, with only 2 having progressive income taxes. On the other side, 7 of the 10 states losing the most Americans have progressive income taxes, many with exorbitant rates. California is joined by New York, Illinois, New Jersey, and Massachusetts as the states losing residents the fastest this year. These 5 high-tax states lost nearly 480,000 residents last year. The lesson for policymakers here is clear. The policies you choose have a significant impact on whether your state attracts or loses residents. States that embrace low taxes, minimize burdensome regulation, and foster individual freedom create environments where people and businesses thrive. In contrast, states that burden their residents with high taxes and stifling regulations will continue to see their citizens leave for more competitive states. As it has been throughout our 250 years of history, Americans are still migrating to enhance opportunity for themselves and their posterity. For more information, you can go to alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WJAS-AM in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, WFYL-AM in Jeffersonville, Pennsylvania, along with KADA-FM in Ada, Oklahoma. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.